Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
Ready for a career in behavioral health? Earn your online degree at Herzing University. Choose from health and human services, psychology, or social work programs. Gain the skills to work, coordinate, and manage nonprofits. Secure a bachelor's in psychology to study mental health or advance your social work career through our online Masters of Social Work. Let us help you become a social change agent. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Text HEALTH to 85109. That's HEALTH to 85109. Or visit herzing.edu.
It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hello. I'm here. I'm doing all right.
Yeah, that's right. It's episode 192. We're talking about processed food. We'll get into that very shortly, but you know, we got some stuff to talk about first. One, how the heck are you, man? Like, I feel like you're back. You're in the hospital doing real work. How are things going?
So I'm on my second round of work at the new hospital, my new job, working with residents and medical students, seeing plenty of patients, doing a lot of teaching, and that's really what I enjoy doing a lot. So that's been good so far, and I'm looking for ways to kind of expand the teaching that I'm doing there to help develop some of these residents into independent clinicians in the coming years. So that's what I've been up to in the past couple weeks.
Now, is the team smaller than what you had before, about the same size, or what's going on?
The actual team that I work with in terms of a senior resident and two interns usually, and then a couple medical students is quite similar to what I've had in other places. The volume of patients that we see seems to be on average a little bit less. Although again, I have a limited, experience to base that off of so far, only 4 weeks in this current place compared to where I've been before, where things have potentially been a lot busier at certain times. So we'll see how it goes. But regardless of how many patients I have, I just tend to find ways to make things educational and make things teachable for them. So that's what I've been up to.
You know what I miss? It's like the changing, like we just went through a heat wave and now it's gotten a little, you know, we're at the end of summer, beginning of autumn, and it's the back to school kind of thing. And one of my friends just started medical school.
Yeah.
And I'm like, man, what an exciting time. I kind of miss it, you know, a little bit, not like the grind of studying or, you know, whatever, just kind of like slogging through, oh, I got an immunology test and but I don't know. It's exciting. Just starting something brand new and you feel like, man, I'm just one step in this journey that's going to.
Yeah, I mean that's my favorite part is seeing these adult learners, I'll say, come in and seeing where they start and where they end up over time, seeing them gain confidence in their clinical skills and their, you know, ability to reason through complicated cases and manage things that they maybe didn't think that they used to be able to manage. All that stuff is a lot of fun.
You know, it'd be cool if we had a barbell medicine like mentorship program kind of thing. You get that with your residents, but I don't get that except for, you know, the people in our seminars and in my DMs and stuff. But it'd be interesting if we had a core group of people that we were working with over a period of time. I don't know, something to think about.
What's up with your training? How are things going there?
Training is good. I have a meet in, I think it's 8 weeks from now. So trying to, I don't know, temper kind of expectations in a way. Like I had a really great training cycle before my last meet. And a lot of that was because, at least the way I think about it, is because the pressure was off. I was literally just coming back from that shoulder dislocation. And so this time around, I'm kind of, instead of expecting like, oh, you're all firing all cylinders, let's go. It's more like, just have fun with the training. And you know, what's there on meet day is what's there on meet day. I just think putting unnecessary pressure on myself is something I'm prone to do. Mm-hmm. And it just makes my training worse. Yeah. Like I don't enjoy it as much. I don't get as much out of it. And I don't, you know, I don't stick to the plan as much. And even, and that's after, you know, over a decade of training. And it's just like knowing my tendency, I'm like, well, I still put in enough work today, so I'm good.
Yeah.
And
those kind of thought processes happen to the best of us. and you had talked recently, and part of the reason I bring it up is because you'd mentioned that book by Steve Magnus, Do Hard Things, which I'm about halfway through at this point. And it's just been funny. I pinged you the other day. I was like, I feel like I could have written this book because so many of the topics that are discussed are things that we have discussed among ourselves about our training or at seminars or with our clients. I mean, I think one of the more significant ones was this whole concept of like, rather than using the metric of your success being peak performance at any given time, thinking more about like bringing up the floor of your performance. Like what is your average any day, you know, kind of single at 7 or something like that. And if that's going up, then that's actually a much more a reassuring thing as far as progress goes compared to like the heaviest you've ever lifted, which the more advanced you get may happen once every couple of years or something, depending on how things go. So there's a lot of good messages in that book, at least so far, that I'm halfway through it. I know you finished it. I recommended it to, I recommended that Sam, my client, Sam Calhoun, read it, because I was like, this book reflects a lot of the conversations we've had over the years that we've worked together. And she was like, reading it now. And she's like, oh yeah, this is exactly what we talked about. So would recommend.
Yeah. Great book. I DM'd Mr. Magnus, see on Twitter. So we'll see if we can get him on the podcast. Cause it's funny. Somebody tweeted like at him and me at the same time. Uh-huh. And he was like, oh man, that's so great. Like I'm super pumped that you guys are following my stuff. And I was like, yeah, man, you seem like a good dude. Let's maybe we'll get him on the podcast. So
cool.
Yeah, we'll see what happens 7 weeks from now. No real pressure. I just, you know, steady improvement. That'd be nice. And then, wrapping up the motocross season and, feeling good about being musculoskeletally intact. It was just, you know, what's interesting is like, having been removed from it for so long, I actually did way better than I thought I was going to do. And it's been way more enjoyable. My dad even said to me, he goes, yeah, you got a lot better. I didn't really expect that. And I was like, but yeah, no, that's been interesting. And so we'll see. Yeah, next year, I think with all these extracurriculars between racing, golf, and training, I'm actually going to need to plan out kind of like the competitive year if I really want to do something special in any of those disciplines. Otherwise, it's just kind of like, yeah, I'm having fun, which is also fine. I just don't, you know,
yeah.
I think just some higher level planning is going to be useful. I have not seen you post on Instagram in a minute, so I assume that your training is not going great, but it's adequate.
It's okay. I've just mentally not been super interested at the moment, so I'm actually in rare form taking a little bit of a break from like pushing heavy singles and things like that. I'm doing other stuff and spending more time in the pool and actually doing some stuff on the bike and things like that. So
cardio, Austin,
not like road bike, but on the air bike and stuff like that. But actually more time in the pool is really what's happening at the moment, which you can relate to with going back to your prior sport as well. So still in the gym, still lifting, nothing particularly interesting, but getting faster in the water again is cool.
So in motocross, like the thing that kind of tells me, like that kind of limits my, how fast I can go or whatever, is this exertional compartment syndrome on my forearms. I'm actually considering like getting a procedure done to like a fasciotomy to not have to deal with that anymore. But that's like my limiter in swimming. What is your limiter? Like, cause it's not so much that you're out of breath, cause you're underwater, right? Like
you're always sort of out of breath.
Yeah. So what's like, how do you know that, pushing too quickly or my pace is too fast?
Ugh, not something I've thought of, since so much of it is just like an intuitive feel at this point of like, oh, I just know this is not a good idea. But you definitely, the consequences of such decisions manifest quite apparently. And so I remember like some races where either I went out way too hard, or when I used to coach swimming, like a swimmer of mine would have gone out too hard. And then really what you tend to see is like stroke efficiency goes way down. And so whereas typically you're able to like, you know, get a fair amount of distance per stroke, if things are going really efficiently, that shortens up a ton. And so, you know, when I'm coaching people's technique to improve, a lot of times I'm trying to get them to take fewer strokes per length and lengthen things and get more efficient, pull more water with each stroke. When that shortens up, when you're taking a ton of strokes to not move very far and like your muscles feel like they're shutting down and they're not cooperating, that's usually the feel that you get. And so typically, you know, it is most often not so much of a respiratory breathing thing, because if you're trying to go really fast, if you're trying to sprint, then you're deliberately not breathing. So typically, like in a 50 freestyle or something, you're doing it on zero breaths or maybe one breath. So that's definitely less of the limiter. And you're not going to like tap out from fatigue in a race that short, but like the 200 free, 500 free kind of things, like if you blow it out way too fast, then you're going to hurt really badly coming home, and your stroke is going to shorten up a ton, and you're not going to be moving very far with each stroke. I think that probably at this point for me, like a bigger limiter is actually my legs, which is interesting, but I think a lot of it has to do with how much more muscle mass there is on them and how much oxygen they can consume if I'm actually kicking really hard. And so most of my swimming right now involves very light kicking. I'm not pushing, like spinning the wheels very hard, just because like they can probably suck up so much oxygen and burn out more quickly. So that's probably a common limiter for some folks too.
Yeah. You've gotten so good at like not only creating energy, but also using energy super quickly so that you can lift heavy weights that now you're like, oh, well, it's got to be submaximal kind of, but then also like sustained. And you're like, kind of need to train this a little bit.
Right.
Interesting. All right. Well, we'll keep the audience updated on your swimming exploits. We'll wait for you to get the barbell medicine jammers. You can get out there and represent. Just as a reminder, we do have some live in-person seminars coming up. We're in Los Angeles in November of this year. We'll also be in Atlanta at Alpha Strength and Power in February of 2023. And then we'll be in New York at CrossFit South Brooklyn in May. And then our pain and rehab team, they're in Miami in January. So if you want to join us or our pain and rehab team at one of our live in-person seminars, you can check the link in the description below. Get signed up. I know the spots are going quickly, but we'd love to see you at a seminar. And also, our whey protein is back in stock. Whey RX, it is a whey protein isolate. It only has 80 calories. It's got nothing in it, but just whey protein isolate and a little sweetener. It's back in stock, available on our website. You can get that with the link in the description below as well. And that leads us right into today's topic. Austin, did you know that a protein supplement is considered an ultra-processed food?
I think I did, because I think we've talked about this before, but I can see how that might not be intuitive to everybody.
That's right. Yeah. And so today we're going to talk about processed foods, what that means, not only just definition wise, but also like for health, for public policy. And, you know, what about the recommendation, you know, hey, just eat less processed foods. Like, is that any good? So let's kick this off with some definitions. What is food processing and what is a processed food? So food processing is a critical element in the food supply chain. Processed foods have been a part of civilization since ancient times in an effort to improve things like preservation, so avoiding food spoilage and foodborne diseases, palatability, make foods better tasting and increase the bioavailability of the nutrients therein, so cooking, for example, the stability during transportation, so you can take food with you, and also convenience, so you're expending less daily resources for obtaining and making food that you can eat. So fire for roasting meat and cooking foods has been discovered in civilizations that were about 2 million years old. So we've been doing this for a long time. Same thing with drying and smoking. That's dating back to 6,000 years ago. And in more recent times, pasteurization, sterilization. And now, particularly recently, there's a lot of new food technology and food processing technology that's trying to improve the sustainability and the access that different people have to different foods. So practically speaking, all food is processed in some way. And without it, we'd have a tough time obtaining food. I mean, realistically, no food that we're obtaining unless you like grow it and don't do anything to it, you know, as far as like removing the inedible parts, for example, cooking, washing, etc. Practically all the food, even if you're, you know, a farmer, is processed in some way. We'll talk more about this later, but one idea behind classifying food according to its degree of processing is that in categorizing it, it may allow people to make more informed decisions about the relative healthfulness or health-promoting nature of the foods that they're choosing to consume. And so to do this, the most commonly used food classification system with respect to processing is called the NOVA food classification system. This was published in about 2000, I think it's 15 is when it first came out. But then the a lot of the papers from Montero, who is out of Brazil, came out in 2019. But like 95% of the papers on food processing and how that relates to health and this, that, and the other use the NOVA food classification system. And so invariably people go, what does NOVA even mean? It's not an acronym. It's just
It's just who they are.
It's just a word. Yeah.
Made it up.
Yeah. And so the goal of this classification system is to classify all foods according to the nature, extent, and purposes of the industrial processes they undergo. It is by far, the most commonly used food processing classification system used in the literature. And there are four main groups. So group one relates to unprocessed or minimally processed foods, so things like fruit, vegetables, eggs, meat, milk, water, et cetera. I actually had a person in my on one of my Instagram posts where I was talking about trying to alter the food environment to improve dietary pattern. And I was like, well, if you get rid of or reduce the access to processed foods, that may result in a better dietary pattern. And she was like, water is an ultra processed food. And I'm like, actually, no, it's group one, so minimally processed, but thanks for playing.
Somebody had to put those hydrogens and that oxygen together. Okay?
That's right. That dihydrogen oxide is going to kill you. Yeah. Group one tends to be unprocessed or minimally processed foods. I've linked the entire NOVA classification system document in the description below, so you guys can check that out afterwards. Group two, these are mostly culinary ingredients that are processed with things like oils, sugar, salt, etc. They are rarely consumed by themselves, but usually they're added to foods to extend their shelf life, sort of that preservation kind of thing, so less food spoilage. Group three, it's called processed. They're the processed foods. These are foods obtained by combining foods, both group one and two. You combine both of those and you get these group three foods. This includes stuff like bread, canned vegetables and fruits, bacon, smoked fish, simple cheeses with salt added to them. Processed foods usually retain the basic identity and most constituents of the original food, but again, a little bit higher level of processing to make them a little tastier. Help with preservation and shelf life, also transportation. So those are the first three groups. And group four is the group that we're probably going to spend the most time on during this podcast. These are the ultra-processed foods, UPFs. They are the ones that use many different ingredients, including food additives, and the ingredients are rarely used in home food preparation. They also use industrialized processing techniques to improve palatability and, again, preservation. So things like sweetened cereals, pastries, pre-prepared meat, pasta, pizza dishes, chips, etc. These are, again, the foods that most people are probably referring to when they talk about processed foods. They're really not referring to group three type foods. They're usually these ultra-processed foods. And the most common sort of added ingredients are added salt, added sugar, and added fat, often in much higher concentrations that are in processed foods. So the difference would be like, you can buy pre-packaged chicken breast, for example, right? And usually they add salt and maybe a few other preservatives so that you can transport and preserve the chicken so it doesn't spoil as quickly. But there's also ultra-processed chicken that has a bunch of additional additives and added fat and sometimes added sugars, whatever, which kind of change the nature of what you're eating. So Austin, if you had to predict or estimate rather, how much of your diet do you think is composed of these ultra processed foods versus processed foods?
I think I've described my typical diet as having some oats and some whey, and then, I would say unprocessed meats like chicken and fish fall in there, vegetables, some rice, potatoes, things like that. Probably the most highly processed thing that I have is ice cream. And then if you're counting whey protein as in this category, then I guess that would fit as well. But as far as like candy or pastries or things like that, almost never. Pizza is like a rare thing that I might consume. So I don't know, less than 20% for sure, I would say.
Yeah, I would say in my weekly dietary pattern, yeah, the group four stuff, it represents 10 to 20% tops. And most of that's going to be either whey or a protein bar or, you know, some meal that I don't normally consume, but is quite tasty.
Exactly.
but that is not reflective of the current dietary pattern in most civilized societies. So ultra processed foods make up more than half of the total dietary energy consumed in high income countries like the United States, Canada, and the UK, and between 1/5 and 1/3 of total dietary energy in middle income countries such as Brazil, Mexico, and Chile. The amount of ultra processed foods that are consumed are growing, and sales are also going up about 1% per year in high-income countries and up to 10% per year in middle-income countries. They tend to be a little cheaper. And so the amount of ultra-processed foods that are being consumed are increasing. In the United States and the UK, over 55% of the average daily energy intake now comes from ultra-processed foods. And those in the highest quintiles of ultra-processed food consumption consume over 75% of their daily energy intake from ultra-processed foods. They're becoming increasingly more prevalent in the diets of infants, children, and adolescents. And so you think about, like, what are the, you know, externalities of that introduction early on in life? You know, you're having these things early in your sort of food journey. And so what does that do like later on in life?
Yeah, across on a variety of fronts, not only the direct health impacts that may begin at that time, but also impacts on longer term food preferences and things like that. Like if you're having this stuff that, you know, I'm sure we'll get into this a little bit, but as far as like the systems that are involved in influencing and regulating our appetite, we have obviously this one system, it's called the homeostatic system, that responds to like, okay, do you need calories or not, right? Your actual physiological need for food. But the one that's more relevant here is the system called the hedonic system, which refers to more like kind of pleasure seeking type, you know, behavior. And so when that is just getting like maximally lit up by these foods, you know, the rest of your life, if you tried to backtrack, if that's what you were exposed to really early on, it's interesting to think about what could be the implications of that. And like, could you ever feasibly really go back if that's what you were, you know, brought up on, primed with, things like that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting. Most of the dietary guidelines currently focus on ingredients that are common in processed foods. So like if you look at the 2020 to 2025 dietary guidelines for Americans, they explicitly say, you know, let's avoid foods with added salt or sodium, to be more particular, avoid foods with added fats, and avoid foods with added sugars, particularly of the refined variety. But they don't actually say, hey, let's avoid processed foods, point blank. That's kind of in contrast to a few other guidelines that have been published. So for example, the 2021 American Heart Association scientific statement on dietary guidance to improve cardiovascular health says, choose minimally processed food instead of ultra processed foods, but no like particular description of what those things are. And then also like, and one of the themes we'll kind of keep coming back to is like, what are the odds that people can like pick out, oh, this is a processed food and this is non-processed food? Cause you know, there's kind of a gray zone. Like,
yeah.
And it's funny because you kind of go down the list when you read this NOVA classification system, you're like, okay, so is fat-free Greek yogurt, that's probably minimally processed, but if they added fruit and sugar to it, now that's ultra processed.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, you almost needed a degree in this stuff to kind of to know what it is. But yeah, a few other guidelines, like the High Council on Public Health of France put a goal. Yeah, I know, right? The High Council.
Seems like they're in Game of Thrones or something.
I was just thinking that. I was like, man, they probably got dragons over there. One of their goals is a 20% reduction in ultra-processed food consumption as a goal from 2018 to 2022. So I have low hopes that they've achieved that goal, because it seems like all civilized countries, the ultra-processed food intake's going up.
Think about what would be necessary if the intake is upwards of 50%, to achieve a 20% reduction in that is not an insignificant amount. And you are, again, as we've talked about at length before, like how much of our eating behavior and food selection and things like that are driven by subconscious processes and things like that. So just telling people, don't eat these foods, not going to work, and certainly not going to achieve that level of reduction. And so it's kind of like when people hate on the dietary guidelines, when it's like, actually, most of the guidelines are fine. The issue is that, you know, people don't follow them. And then we should be kind of working on why is that the case? And much of that revolves around the food environment. So like, is France, if this is their goal, willing to heavily modify the food environment through, you know, legal and regulatory means and things like that, if possible, and, you know, risk getting called, you know, nanny state communists and things like that, just like we do when we bring this topic up.
Yeah. I mean, so the thought here is that if you recommend that people avoid specific nutrients, so like avoid foods with added sodium, added fats, and added sugars, or other components of ultra processed foods, is that a good dietary recommendation? Can you just tell people to avoid ultra processed foods? And is that a good recommendation? And, you know, you kind of hinted at why this may not be a, you know, a series of great recommendations. But I think before that, let's cover some of the known effects on health that ultra processed foods tend to have. So we have extensive data showing that there's a dose dependent relationship between consumption of ultra processed foods and negative health outcomes. So the more ultra processed foods are found in a dietary pattern, the greater risk of things like obesity, type 2 diabetes, high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, high blood cholesterol, certain cancers, fatty liver disease, kidney disease, depression, death attributable to cardiovascular disease, and from all causes. This is not really surprising, but one of the things that I did find that was really interesting was that for every 1% increase in the national household availability of ultra-processed foods, for every 1% increase, it's associated with a 0.25% increase in the national prevalence of obesity after adjusting for income, physical inactivity, and smoking. So it's just like the more of this stuff that's around portends a bad outcome, which speaks to that food environment thing that you were talking about. It's like
if it's there, you're going to eat it.
Well, that's the thing, right? If it's in your house, you're going to eat it. And even, you know, more when we talk about food environment, it's not just restricted to your home, but what about at work? What about in your local community? It's like if there's a ton of places to obtain very cheap, very energy dense, a lot of calories, and very tasty foods, which are tend to be ultra processed in nature, like, man, that's going to be tough to say no. And yeah. It's going to be tough to say no continuously. So, you know, other connections that we see are increases in ultra-processed food and drink volume sales per capita are also associated with population-level BMI trajectories. So the more ultra-processed food and drinks that are sold, the higher the BMI tends to climb. The only like randomized controlled trial that was done under well-controlled settings. This is by Kevin Hall. I believe it was in 2020 or it might have been 21.
Within the past 2 years, yeah, I think.
Yeah. So basically over a two-week period, they took 20 young adults and half of them consumed a diet with 83% of the energy coming from ultra-processed foods. And the other half consumed a minimally processed food diet. And so those consuming a diet higher in ultra-processed foods actually ate, on average, about 500 more calories per day than the people consuming a minimally processed food diet. And so at the end of 2 weeks, those folks gained about 1 kilo or 2.2 pounds, and the other group actually lost a little bit of weight. And Austin, why is that the expected finding? Because I think when people are hearing this, they're like, okay, so they ate more ultra-processed foods and they ate more calories and they gained weight, like, duh. But like, I think hashing out this food environment thing is probably a little bit more nuanced here. So why is that the expected finding?
Yeah, I mean, we still, and this is ongoing, and this is probably going to be an ongoing argument like forever, where people who are not adequately informed or read up on or educated on the neurobiology of obesity will tend to say, oh, like dealing with obesity, dealing with body fat is a simple thing. Just get people to eat less. You know, it's that simple. And again, that just ignores how complex this neurobiology is and how much of it is happening kind of in these areas of the brain that are called subcortical, that are deep in the brain. And those are reflected in that they are not consciously controlled areas. So I mentioned earlier, these two out of the three major systems that kind of influence our food seeking behavior, our eating behavior, things like that. So we have the homeostatic system that, you know, that responds to our need for calories, our need for energy. the hedonic system that's more like reward, behavioral kind of reinforcement when we find something that we really like, that we enjoy, whatever the case is, pleasure seeking kind of behavior as well as it relates to our eating. And then the frontal areas of our brain that are more of our like conscious executive decision making, the quote unquote kind of willpower areas. And so, you know, when we look at neuroscientific studies on these areas and as they relate to obesity and how they function differently in patients with obesity or people with obesity compared to people without, we see all sorts of differences. And it is very, very clear that the hedonic system, this like pleasure seeking system, it can easily override the homeostatic system, meaning the pleasure seeking system can easily override our like just straight up need for calories, even in the presence of abundant energy supplies. Even when we have plenty of calories, even when we've consumed enough calories for the meal or for the day or for the week, or if we have excess body fat already, we're like flush with calories and energy supply, this hedonic system can still easily override that and drive the overconsumption of highly palatable food. And for folks who don't really understand this neurobiology, they say, oh, these people are just gluttonous or lazy or whatever the case is. But when people do like say certain kinds of neuroimaging studies on this, we see areas where the people with obesity who are in this situation, their kind of reward, behavioral reinforcement, pleasure centers of the brain may light up a little bit less in some situations, requiring more intake to get the same level. The homeostatic systems that are involved in regulation around our energy needs may be less active. The frontal areas of our brain are definitely less active, and those are the areas that get basically inhibited when we're like stressed or sleep deprived or any of these other things that can really limit what people commonly describe as willpower and result in recommendations of like, oh, just try harder. When instead it's like, there's some neurobiology that you are not in control of here, which is where, you know, the food environment plays a major role in driving like, hey, if this is the biology that we're working with, it is going to be expressed in the context of the environment. Right. And so that's where if you're in an environment with all these ultra processed foods everywhere, super high palatability food, high calorie density foods, then that is going to be the natural trajectory of a fraction of the population who's in that environment. Compared to if they're in a very sparse, not calorie dense sort of environment, then that will not manifest with the kind of presentation of increasing body fat and obesity and things like that. And so as we've said on other podcasts, unless we're willing to like revamp and overhaul the food environment using the medical treatments that we have available that more directly target these kind of subcortical appetite regulating areas is our next best bet. And we see data studies on these medications that we're using with increasing frequency these days, that it does better control the signaling in these areas. It does give people better control over their eating behaviors and increasing self-efficacy and suppressing appetite and increasing satiety and things like that. And that's what is leading to, you know, 10, 15, 20, now upwards of 25%+ weight loss with a simple, you know, injection or something like that, because it's kind of restoring normal neurobiological signaling in the context of this profoundly screwed up food environment that people find themselves in and in many cases don't have the luxury of being able to escape it.
Yeah. That preservation of like energy balance, despite having excess energy stores, body fat, you know, that's the root of obesity, right? And so you're just wondering why, like, why are people prone to sort of, or some people, why are they prone to kind of maintaining that energy balance despite having extra energy stores on board? And it's like, well, the food environment is heavily involved in that. And ultra processed foods are certainly contributory to that food environment. And so it'd be interesting to kind of discuss now the mechanisms by which ultra processed foods may kind of hijack that sort of system. Because what you would want to happen is if you had excess energy stores on board, that you'd say, I in response will eat a little bit less to offload some of these energy stores. And so when that doesn't happen, you're like, something is amiss here.
And it's not even that you would consciously decide I'm going to eat a little bit less. It's rather I don't have the appetite to eat as much as I would if my energy stores were lower.
So this is all subconscious stuff. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so why then subconsciously is this thing being hijacked? And so the presence of these ultra processed foods in the food environment tend to be pretty predictive of what happens. And effectively, the mechanisms we're looking at for ultra-processed foods contributing to that hijacking of this appetite satiety sort of regulatory system is basically two main categories, one being the nutrient content of these foods and the other as a direct result of the processing, the ultra-processing process itself. So from this nutrient content perspective, ultra-processed foods tend to be more energy dense, meaning they have more calories per gram. So ultra-processed foods on average have 2.3 calories per gram, and minimally processed or unprocessed foods have 1.1 calories per gram. And so you're thinking, you're like, man, I'm getting over double the amount of calories per, you know, volume of food. So already you're likely to take in more energy that way.
And just think about the impact of that, you know, when you mentioned that there are some countries, say US, UK, for example, where the average energy intake from these foods is upwards of like 50-55% of calories. And there are other countries, we're looking at their data, some of the Mediterranean countries, for example, things like that, they on average tend to eat maybe more on the order of like 20% or something like that from ultra-processed foods. So like if the difference in energy intake from these foods is 20% versus 50%, and then we look at the energy density and it's like over double for the ultra-processed foods compared to non-processed, like think about the compounding effects of all of that over long periods of time in the population.
Yeah. Additionally, when you look at the nutrient content, ultra-processed foods tend to have high amounts of added fat, particularly saturated fat, added sugars, so sugar that's not already in the food stuff itself, it's added to the food, and then added sodium. And it's kind of like the three horses of the apocalypse right there, because that combination of food tends to really trigger that hedonic sort of appetite system. You put those things together, ooh, it's salty, ooh, it's got fat, ooh, it's sweet. You put that together and it's like, man, I could eat anything. That's like when the cake comes out and you're full and you're like, I could eat that cake.
And it's really worth pointing out that, like, you know, there are people who in diet circles will still be blaming like singular nutrients or singular ingredients or singular food components, or say it's the carbs or it's the fat or it's the sugar, whatever the case is. When it's like, if you actually looked at those ingredients in isolation, like let me sit you down in front of a bowl of table sugar, show me how much you can eat. Or let me sit you down in front of a glass of, you know, of olive oil or something like that. Show me how much calories you can overconsume.
Right.
It's not that thing uniquely. These particular combinations that, of course, with, you know, economic incentives, food industry has landed upon the thing that lights your brain up as much as possible.
Yeah.
both from an ingredient standpoint and from a textural standpoint.
Yeah. So it's not like people are, they're ODing on, you know, sugar cubes or, you know, like you said, olive oil, but hamburgers.
Yeah.
Well, you betcha. Chips, you betcha. Pizza, you betcha. Yeah. So in addition to having more added fat, more added sugar, and more added sodium, there's less fiber, less protein, and other micronutrients. And so, you know, you start thinking about like, if a particular food or nutrient is displaced from the diet, what are people eating to compensate for that? And it's like, all right, so we got less fiber, less protein, less micronutrients, and we're eating more fat, more sugar, more sodium because of the high intake of ultra-processed foods. Like, and they're more energy dense and they're less filling. Like, what is that? That sets us up for just eating more calories. And that's exactly what you see. You see with higher intakes of ultra-processed foods, you see higher energy intakes. And so it should be no surprise that these things track together. Increased body weight, increased BMI, increased body fatness, et cetera, correlate with increased ultra-processed food intake. And so, yeah, it's the exact expected response. And that's just, again, one of these two categories just from the nutrient content of ultra-processed foods themselves. From a direct result of the processing, these things become super, super tasty. So flavor, texture, mouthfeel, et cetera. You got food scientists working around the clock trying to figure out ways to hack your brain. And I'm not throwing the food scientists under the bus. Look, some of these things are tasty. And for that, I thank you. Okay.
Yes.
but like there are, as you said, the incentives for creating really tasty foods that don't necessarily fill you up, but rather force you to eat more. I mean, that's the whole thing here. And so when you have these industrialized food processing techniques, you can create these sort of Frankenfoods that are super, super tasty. And yeah, again, by the way, they have added calories in them, added sugar, added salt, added fat. And you're like, which makes those things combined, again, just on their own, make you want to eat more in addition to these other techniques that make them more palatable.
One of my favorite things, I don't know if this is still their motto because I haven't eaten a bag of Lay's chips in a very long time, but how it literally says on the bag, like, I bet you can't eat just one. It's like, they're just telling you straight up.
Like. Well, was it Pringles is like, once you pop, you can't stop?
And yes, it's like, yeah. These companies, they don't, they're like, we'll tell you the game. We know you're weak. You can't handle this.
Yeah, exactly. The other part that I thought was interesting, we talk about this thing called like the food matrix, and that's basically like the sum of the food is greater than its individual parts. And so when we talk about like health benefits from eating fruits and vegetables, it's not just because, you know, one weird molecule or flavonoid or phytonutrient that's in the actual vegetable or fruit itself, but the combination of all of those flavonoids, all of the phytonutrients, all of the minerals, et cetera, together have this unique effect that tends to promote health. But when these foods are highly processed, you have less of these things in them. And there may be some changes in the gut microbiome, maybe some differences in how we metabolize them. Although, you know, it's unclear what the net effect is of this processing, but it's certainly a potential mechanism that ultimately results in increased energy intake, lower feelings of fullness. So people tend to eat more. And again, I think if you had to drill down, you know, what is the major sort of underlying effect of increased ultra processed food consumption, it's going to be increased energy intake. Would you be on board with that?
I would be on board with that as the primary driver. Of course, there can be secondary or tertiary, like smaller effects, but yeah, that's probably where I'd lean.
And so just to kind of hammer this home, like why this has become such an issue and has, you know, probably been one of the root causes of the, you know, obesity epidemic and whatnot. In the last 50 years, calorie intake from sources outside the home has grown from about 15% to 33% of an individual's daily energy intake. So people are eating more meals, more food outside the home than ever before. You know, based on a 2012 analysis of the 2007 to 2008 National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey data, 41% of adults consumed foods from fast food type restaurants and 27% from full service restaurants during the 24 hours prior to the survey. That's just the day before. Imagine if you had like a whole month's worth of data. And so, yeah, people are eating outside the home more than ever. There are more opportunities to eat outside the home more than ever. And what do you think these meals or these foods that people are eating are comprised of? You think they're minimally processed, very fresh, no process? Like, of course not. They're more processed, more added stuff to make them tastier. And
the incentives from the restaurant standpoint are not necessarily we want you to like eat as much as possible, but rather like we want you to come back and like order more stuff. So there are similarly perverse incentives from the standpoint of keeping the population, you know, consuming a generally guideline concordant health promoting diet and keeping them lean.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of interesting, you know, because people will say, well, yeah, those. You know, restaurants or those, you know, convenience stores or whatever that sell these types of foods, they're there, sure. But what if we just had more healthy opportunities for people to eat? Wouldn't that, you know, change the game here? And the data on that is pretty interesting. So a couple term that people may have heard before is called a food desert. It's a particular type of food environment that's discussed in the scientific literature. A food desert, for example, is an area with limited access to healthy foods. It's basically determined by the distance between the home and local supermarkets or other establishments, including restaurants that have healthy foods. There's another term that's much less frequently discussed, and it's called a food swamp. Food swamps are areas that have increased access to fast food or other unhealthy food choices as measured by the density of these establishments in relation to the home. And so both food deserts and swamps are associated with poor dietary quality, higher BMI, and an increased risk of obesity. However, even when supermarkets and stores are built in food deserts that have healthy foods or other foods that could be part of a health promoting dietary pattern, the BMI values and overall diet quality tend to stay the same. So effectively, the bigger predictive factor here in a person's dietary pattern and ultimately how much energy they take in per day is how much access do they have to these ultra processed foods and to these highly energy dense foods that are cheap, heavily marketed, et cetera.
Because human brains are going to do what human brains do, as we have established.
Yeah, I mean, it's like if you kept a bunch of tasty treats in the home, right? It's like if you have an abundance of these things in the home, it is going to be very difficult for you not to eat them. Now, and if you scale that up to your whole community, it's like, man, every corner I go, I got this opportunity to eat these just very tasty.
Just because like a salad shop opens up on the corner doesn't mean that suddenly it's going to fix things.
A salad shop. Have you ever been to Tender Greens? You've been,
no,
been there? Oh, okay. Yeah, I got my first exposure to that when I moved to LA, and I was like, oh man, this place is great. But you know what's right next to Tender Greens? Crack Shack. And let me tell you, 10 out of 10 prefer Crack Shack to Tender Greens. Yeah, that's if you guys haven't had Crack Shack, if you come to San Diego area, 10 out of 10 would recommend. But again, don't take it home with you. And you know, maybe just a touch. So yeah, overall, people are more likely to consume these ultra processed foods compared to minimally processed options if they're more prevalent in the environment. And if they consume more ultra processed foods, they're likely to consume a higher energy intake per day. And with a higher energy intake per day, particularly if it is in excess of what they need, or if it sort of hijacks that appetite satiety sort of relationship that's going on subconsciously, people are going to preserve those excess energy stores by preserving energy balance. And that's, again, these aren't conscious decisions. It's just kind of happening because, as you said, human brains are going to do what human brains do. So it seems like we're saying that ultra processed foods tend to not be health promoting, but I don't want to paint this all like bleak picture, like, hey, all food processing is bad. Don't process anything. Let's just get back to the land. And, you know, everybody's got a garden or whatever. I don't think that's the solution. So for example, food insecurity is a big deal. About 10%, 13.5 million U.S. households were food insecure at some point during 2021. And that was about the same in 2020. Now, this isn't the same as hunger. They're closely related, but they're different concepts. So hunger refers to a personal physical sensation or of discomfort, while food insecurity refers to a lack of available financial resources for food at the household level. Ultra-processed foods are kind of filling that gap because they tend to be cheaper and therefore may be beneficial at reducing food insecurity for individuals who have a lower socioeconomic status, lower financial resources to actually, you know, spend on food. And so when you actually look at like food prices over the years, ultra-processed foods did not increase in price as much as unprocessed foods over the last 12 years. They're lower per calorie cost-wise. So it's about 55 cents versus $1.45. Per calorie. And you think about like, man, if you had limited resources to spend on food, it's going to be difficult to eat a minimally processed food diet. In addition to other things like having enough time to cook, knowing how to cook, having a working, you know, oven, microwave, places to store food, all these other sorts of things. But just the actual purchasing of the food is going to be difficult. And, you know, consistent with the evidence that higher socioeconomic status individuals in the U.S. have higher quality diets, ultra-processed foods make up a lower proportion of energy intake among highly educated and higher income individuals. And again, this is kind of what you would expect. If you have these additional resources and you have been more resources as far as cooking goes, more education, et cetera, you're likely to need to rely on ultra-processed foods to a lower degree. I mean, that's just kind of what we see here. This isn't perfect, of course, you know, just because we're kind of reducing food insecurity via having more ultra-processed foods available. These foods, again, tend to have lower nutrient density. So they have less, you know, fiber, flavonoids, phytonutrients, et cetera, good stuff that you want in the foods per calorie. And they also have a higher energy density. So again, more calories per volume of food. And it's like, well, just because we're not hungry, you know, we're less food insecure, doesn't mean that we're feeding you the right stuff.
Yeah, there may be some, you know, plenty of if to the extent that you are averting food insecurity, you may be incurring harms or costs in other ways. And so that's a tough situation without an easy answer to you know, avert all possible bad outcomes is kind of a utopian vision, I think, at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. The other part, and this is probably more, I guess, interesting to me, is that food processing may like be our road to improving sustainability of our whole food supply. So developing zero discard, zero waste, zero lost like technologies and other ways to like improve food yield and less spoilage and easier transport and a more, you know, well-designed global food supply chain, that's all going to require new processing techniques. And some of those foods are likely going to fall into the ultra processed food category. What you would hope, though, is that those ultra processed foods do not remove the fiber, do not remove the protein, do not remove, you know, these other sorts of good stuff that we want within the food, and don't add things like salt, sugar, fat, et cetera, that make them more palatable. And I think when you look at food sustainability stuff, now I'm certainly not an expert in food sustainability, the processes aren't like, yeah, we just added a bunch of salt to this and it made it better. They're talking about a whole bunch of different biological things that I am not aware of like how that even works. But we'll see what happens over the next few years with respect to food processing techniques that improve the sustainability of our food supply chain.
And to the extent that any of that work on a food item that results in it being more sustainable or whatever the case is, to the extent that any of that work lands it in a higher processing category, I think we still care less about that label compared with, you know, evidence on what is the health impact of this particular food on humans. And as always, when we talk about, you know, food and diet and nutrition and things like that, it's always like, and comparing that with what, like, if you're going to eat this compared with eating that in some quantity or some amount, what's the health impact? We care about evidence on that and in humans much, much, much more than we care. Oh, this, because of these processes that were involved, that lands it in group 3 and therefore it's bad, or group 4, and that means it's bad, whatever the case is. So like the label there means a bit less. However, if we do see all of those features that we have discussed that typically lead to spontaneous overconsumption, all these negative health impacts, pulling out fiber and phytonutrients and jacking up sugar, added sugar and sodium content, stuff like that, then we can plausibly predict that this is going to have, you know, net harm on the health of the person, particularly if it's compared with, you know, food items that we would consider more generally healthful. And so that's kind of like the perspective that I would take to the extent that we see new and emerging kind of food items come into the supply, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, the take home for me is like, yeah, we know that there's converging evidence that a healthy diet consists predominantly of whole plant-based foods, including fruit, vegetables, legumes, nuts, whole grains, and, you know, lean animal products. Cool. That's generally not being argued, you know, outside of like some maybe fringe groups. The question really here is like, should we be recommending that folks consume less ultra processed foods? And does that label actually matter? And I think you would have to have this very expensive public health campaign where you're labeling all these foods as like group 1, group 2, group 3, group 4. And then like this education program where people realize that group 4 ultra processed foods tend to, on average, have these, you know, added sugar, added fat, added sodium. And then that tends to make people eat more. And so if you like did all of that, then maybe the recommendation to eat less ultra processed foods results in the behavioral change we want, which is for people to eat more satiating full foods and not overconsume these foods that predominate the local food environment. But then that goes back to the food environment. And so does that recommendation actually change the food environment? I don't know how you do that, man.
Yeah, this is complicated stuff. And I think that hopefully all the times over the years, I guess, that these topics have come up on the podcast have helped to illustrate to people how complex of a problem this is. And it's, you know, it helps to illustrate how if you look at like population level health data, I saw an interesting graph recently. It had a graph of the rates of obesity over the prior 100 years, and it was stratified by age demographic, like by each 10-year increment of like birth cohort or something like that. And they were all going up in parallel at each point along the way. And it was like, imagine looking at this and thinking that like every generation is spontaneously just becoming more progressively lazy every decade or something like that. And it's like, that is such it's not, I can't even call it reductionist just because it's wrong.
Brain
it's
like,
it's a smooth brain take. I like that. So it's just take. Profoundly complex stuff that's happening neurobiologically with the person. And then putting that in the context of the environment, which has changed so rapidly, makes it really difficult. So, yeah, we got a tough problem ahead of us here.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big issue with the ultra processed foods is what they do to the hunger and satiety kind of, you know, system, and that how prevalent they are.
What they would be displacing from the diet if they were not present, right? So the things that they just, that's an added layer of like potential harm is like, what would people be eating instead if you could snap your fingers and make them non-existent, what would people be eating? And on average, I would guess, to the extent that food insecurity was not as much of an issue, then probably more healthful foods.
Yeah. I just think, like I said, if you just tell people to eat less processed foods, it's like, I don't know that results in the behavior that we want. It's kind of like just telling people to eat less and move more. It's like,
yeah.
No, I want to eat the most health promoting food.
It's
not available, or because of the food environment, like I can't consciously choose to do that all the time.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. Tough. Yeah. So if you're listening to this and you're like, man, you guys, you got real political there at the end. It's like, well,
political topic.
yeah, it's going to be tough. Yeah, if you really want to solve this problem, it's going to take some policy change at every level of, the food manufacturing, food marketing, all the sort of stuff. I don't have an answer. You know, I just know that those things are going to have to change. So anyway, this has been episode 192 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. Take home here is that to the extent you can consume a minimally processed diet, like do that. To the extent you can modify your food environment so that that becomes the automatic default behavior, do that. Things outside of your control, do the best you can. And we support you in that journey. Austin, anything you want to leave the audience with?
There was actually one thing that I meant to mention when we were talking about, are they all bad? And so there is a role for these foods, I think, in certain like clinical populations. So for people who demonize, you know, these more processed foods, you know, universally, I think that that probably reflects that they have never seen somebody who has absolutely no appetite from like some bad medical condition, from bad, you know, from being on chemotherapy, from heart failure, from like advanced, you know, other diseases. And so it's like, if that person who's in front of me, if I want to sit them down in front of a meal of like, you know, lentils and salmon and some other stuff, it's like 0% of that is going down. But if I can get them to have a super tasty shake that, yes, it may have some sugar in it, it may have some other things in it, may be fortified, you know, with vitamins and minerals rather than those coming from their from whole food sources and things like that, I will take that deal 10 out of 10 times for a patient who's in that kind of a situation. So just a little side note of like a place where they actually have, you know, more utility than people might give them credit for.
Yeah. Also, like I said, whey protein is, you know, an ultra processed food and actually tends to be very, very satiating. Can be beneficial if you need to take in more protein. The other thing I would say is that, well, we're not saying you should never eat ultra processed foods. It's just that if you are trying to regulate your energy intake on some level, it's going to require more conscious willpower, or as you have called the dietary RPE, is going to go up because these things tend to be less satiating and promote a higher energy intake. And so it's like, look, if you want the Pop-Tarts, eat the Pop-Tarts, but just know that you may compensate less completely later on when it comes time to eat your next meal. And so to the extent that that is one of your goals, you're just going to take that into consideration. But it's, you know, saying it's all bad or all good, I feel like, yeah, another smooth brain take. Cool. All right, cool. So all of the links to not only our seminars, our protein, all of our information and the articles that we talked about here are linked in the description below. So check that out. Before you go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we can keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. For Dr. Austin Baraki, I'm Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum. We'll see you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Coriant. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.